Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's April the 4th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, we'll start out with a little news commentary regarding the events in Texas, where a district attorney and his wife were assassinated, and the blame is being placed on, you guessed it, wicked, evil, white supremacists. Not Mexican drug cartels. Oh, no, 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 that can never be, because that would mean admitting that Mexican drug cartels are operating in this country. And we can't have that now, can we? The so-called white supremacists in this case are an alleged Texas offshoot of the shadowy Aryan Brotherhood prison gang, and they're trying to tie this in with an assistant DA in the same county who got whacked in front of the courthouse 2 months ago because he worked on an AB case, and also with the shooting of the Colorado prison system commandant several weeks ago, where the alleged shooter once again was a so-called white supremacist who ended up conveniently dead, so no one will ever know just what the hell happened there. Okay, I'm not going to comment very extensively on this latest development because it's not yet clear what's actually going on, and they may change their story by the time I've uploaded this podcast to the site. I will say that the AB has been around for about 40 years now, and if it is them, then this is the first time I've ever heard of them, or any other white prison gang for that matter, getting this proactive. So it's a complete change in the pattern and their modus operandi. Now, if that is the case, and if we are in fact witnessing the first systematic white resistance in this country in 30 years, then we could be in for some very interesting developments. However, I'm still not convinced. The fact that both of these killings took place in the same minor rural jurisdiction instead of, say, Houston or Dallas or San Antonio indicates to me that it may well be something specific to Kaufman County, either a personal grudge on the part of someone the local power structure fucked over there, or, like the killing of the Colorado Commandant, it may be some kind of corruption thing. And having lived in Texas, I can tell you that it is very much a part of the Third World, and it has been for some time. Texas politics makes Singapore look honest and straight up. Plus, the media tells us that the DA was shot 20 times. Now, that sounds personal to me. So, I'm going to wait for some more facts to come in before I start pontificating about this one. Now, on to a new organizing and propaganda project for the front. Now, some of you may have heard this mantra, as it's called, that's been circulating, i.e., anti-racist is a code word for anti-white. Okay, granted, that's a good slogan. And it's certainly true as far as it goes. But the problem is that it's a movement slogan. It implies a certain basic pre-knowledge of racial reality and the true nature and agenda of so-called anti-racists, which most normal white people, or low-information voters as Rush Limbaugh calls them, simply don't possess, because they've never been allowed to learn these things. Now, we're dealing with Americans here, and we should never forget how low we have to shoot in order to get a hit. Now, anything we give them by way of PR must be extremely simple, one-dimensional, and expressed in as few words as possible. It must not contain any foreign symbols or words or anything which we need to stop and explain. And when you have to stop and explain something to American white people, you've lost them. They need to be able to ingest it immediately, and it needs to be something that can slip past the socially engineered filters and rejection mechanisms that the Jews have installed in our minds. For first-party contact with normal people, a leaflet is better than a novel, and a slogan is better than a leaflet. The smaller and simpler it is, the easier Americans can get their arms around it. The white Americans have been taught to feel rather than to think, and we must not try to force them to think, at least not at first, because it hurts their heads, literally. Now, this weekend, at a meeting, we had a kind of brainstorming session and came up with something I think will really work well for us. Yeah, I know it's odd to think of liberal blue Seattle being the birthplace of a white racial resurgence, but hey, where else does resistance flourish if not in the presence of the enemy? Okay, comrades, dig it. From now on, the slogan we need to start confronting normal white people with in every way we can is, and I quote, "If white people had a country of our own, this wouldn't be happening." Now that's all. No need to detail what this is. Every man and woman who hears that slogan will be able to fill in their own blanks, because every white man and woman and adolescent who was raised in this politically correct toilet has their own personal horror story to tell. Normal, non-movement white people, especially those now resident in the homeland itself, need to have this pounded through their heads and embedded deeply in their skulls full of mush. However it can be done, internet, business cards, leaflets, creative street art, verbally, by email, by phone, by text, by carrier pigeon, however it can be done, that one simple slogan. If white people had a country of our own, this wouldn't be happening. We begin the process of turning the fish soup back into an aquarium with this one simple mantra. Once that becomes imprinted in someone's cranial ooze, we start working to reconstitute the ooze back into a brain that is capable of thinking rather than just feeling. If white people had a country of our own, this wouldn't be happening. We need to start pounding that simple concept into all those skulls full of mush out there. I naturally tend to try and bring people to the Puget Sound area when I'm talking about Northwest migration, because this is where I live, and quite frankly, I need your help on a lot of things. But there are other areas in the Northwest where we're beginning to develop primary settlement areas. These are places which are desirable in many respects for migration, and where you can actually make a home, a life, a family, so forth and so on. So it's not like Northwest migration automatically means coming here to Seattle and messing around with Harold. This was a problem a little bit during the Aryan Nations days when there was a concept of Northwest migration, but basically in those days what Northwest migration meant was going up to Coeur d'Alene or Hayden Lake and hanging out with Pastor Butler at the compound. We don't have that here. We have several primary settlement areas throughout the Northwest in our 3.5 states that we're claiming for our future Northwest Republic, including Western Montana. We have here Comrade Chris, who is from Montana, the Kalispell area. And we're beginning to get a little bit of settlement out there. And for those of you who like the whole cowboy motif, who like the big sky, who like a lot of wide open space and beautiful scenery, Montana definitely has a lot to recommend itself. Chris, how's things going out there?
Oh, thanks, Harold. Things are going excellent. We have lots of opportunity out there. There's a lot of organic migrants actually move out there. You run into them and find out that they are actually on board with us. There's people that have lived there their whole lives that kind of fall in line with that. It's pretty exciting. There's a lot of good things going on.
How is the economy out there, the job opportunities?
The jobs and the economy, that's one thing that is really good about that area there. The cost of living is a lot cheaper. There's no sales tax. They kind of make up for that with a property tax and whatnot. But the economy is pretty good. And the jobs, they're depending if, you know, the kind of trades and whatnot, they are available. They're out there. If you're willing to go out and look for them, they're there.
What kind of skill set would probably serve you best if you were looking for a job in the Western Montana area? I mean, besides being a cowboy. And by the way, I'm not trying to be funny here. Western Montana is actually the most beautiful part of the state. They do have a lot of cattle ranching and stuff there, but it's not just cowboy country. I don't know if you've ever seen any pictures of it, but it looks to me to be a wonderful place to live. I haven't really been there, but I've driven through it, and I think you probably could do a hell of a lot worse than Western Montana to make your future life in. And anyway, so what kind of skills basically are employers, say, in Kalispell, Missoula, and Western Montana looking for?
You know, they're going to be looking for a variety of things, such as someone that works with their hands, mechanics, machinery. There's a lot of construction that's going on. Anyone in construction, you're going to find your administrative type jobs are going to be around. Also, there are going to be some forestry jobs if you're into forestry. But there's also quite a bit of new growth with different technologies and different things that are moving the area because of the opportunity Montana offers. There's some mining in the area. There's also logging, and we also have landscaping. Some of the work is seasonal. So in the winter, you might be laid off for a month or two. So you have to kind of plan for that. That is something to consider while moving out there.
Well, what is the general lifestyle out there like? What is the racial composition of your particular part of Western Montana?
I would say it's probably 98.5% white. You're going to see Indians. There is Indian reservation close by down there, the Flathead Indian Reservation. As far as Indian reservations go, if you drove through it, you wouldn't even really tell it was the Indian reservation because it's actually quite a clean one. They actually get along. They're not like some of the other Indian reservations that are they're kind of rough, kind of dumpy. It's pretty clean there. It's more of a tourist place. Had a lot of golf courses and stuff there, so if that explains that. But you're going to feel real welcome there. It's, for people that have that moved there that have came out of the South or out of some big metropolitan area, they're usually kind of in shock at all the white people.
I understand that some televangelist or some Christian fundamentalist type, and I cannot remember this guy's name. This was about over a year ago. I know that, but he moved out to the Flathead Valley area in Montana, kind of brought his congregation and whatnot with him. You remember the guy's name? I don't even remember his name.
Oh, yeah, that would be Chuck Baldwin.
Yeah, that's it, that's it. Yeah, and you got your little group of hippy-dippy liberals out there. Was it Montana Human Rights, whatever?
Yeah, that's Montana Human Rights Nitwits, the networks. They're basically an offshoot of the ADL, and they kind of bounce around there. In the 90s, they were after the militia groups there, and then they went after an AM radio host that was out of Kalispell there, John Stokes. Then he went down, they sued him, and they just got to keep the money flowing, so they got on to the next witch hunt.
You know, during the Hayden Lake days, when the Aryan Nations were still going, they had something called the Northwest Coalition Against Malicious Harassment, that's what it was, run by a defrocked priest named Bill Wasmuth. Now, Wasmuth eventually died of AIDS, which I don't know what was going on there, but apparently he'd been defrocked because he couldn't keep his hands off his female parishioners. So with all that, this mess going on in the Catholic Church, God knows what was going on there. I do know they had at least one of their big prominent supporters or members of the so-called Northwest Coalition Against Malicious Harassment arrested for child molesting, things like that. But I found it very odd that out in these very small rural communities, all of a sudden there's this big to-do about this relatively small group of hippy-dippy liberals who obviously would be more at home in Berkeley and San Francisco or in New York City. All of a sudden, they pop up in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and Kalispell, Montana, and places like that. I mean, it's pretty obvious something's going on there. I think most of these people are probably imports, and of course, they've got the local media in their pocket, and so that fact never gets out. But basically, we have a lot of pretty good people in Montana. No actual unit type activity yet, but they all tell me that the local population in your average Montana town, the ordinary working class people, are as solid as rocks. They do not like Obama. They do not like liberal Democrats. They are dead set against any attempt to take people's guns away. And so the actual white people that you will find out there in Montana are probably about the best in the world.
I would absolutely agree with that. I've had more discussions here in the last year after this election. I actually seen guys just look at me and say, what happened? You know, and I found it interesting because I said, well, that's what I said was going to happen. But a lot of people, they really are starting to figure it out that it's not a fair game there. They don't get all that stuff that they were promised, and we're all getting backdoored. So it's interesting. But yeah, like going back on what you said there, that yeah, you're going to find Montanans are generally really hardworking people, give you shirt off your back type people, broke down on the side of the road, run out of gas. They'll pick you up, help you out. It's nice to be in that kind of environment, and it's a good area.
Well, that's generally the type of society you find when you're in an all-white society. You know, normal white people living only among other white people, they're like that. They leave their doors unlocked. They help their neighbors. They kick in when something needs to be done. I saw a little bit of this down in Astoria when we got hit by that hurricane back in 2007. The way the whole community just pulled together to clean up the damage. Nobody waited for FEMA. Nobody waited for government bailouts or anything like that. Once the storm was over, and the storm lasted a while, our power was out for a week. But the minute the wind died down and the sun came up, the local people in Astoria, Oregon, simply started cleaning up their community. And that's because Astoria, Oregon was and still is largely white. We ask people to go to these places and build communities. I admit, we don't have a mob forming to storm the Bastille here in the Northwest yet. That's going to take a long time. And the first step in that is creating these communities of white nationalists or white people who are racially aware all over the Northwest. And so what we want you to do is we want you to come here primarily, and we want you to make your lives here, bring your families, bring your assets, bring your hopes and dreams, and make your lives here. We need to start building communities in every sense of the word here. So when those who come to Western Montana, what kind of general lifestyle can they expect, you think?
Well, they could definitely expect kind of lifestyle where they'd be a lot of outdoors. There's tons and tons of places where you can go hiking, fishing, lots of lakes everywhere, tons of lakes. That area has just got more lakes than probably most areas actually in the rest of the state. I mean, it's a Flathead Lake is actually the largest natural freshwater lake west of the Mississippi. It's unique. Used to be full of salmon, and it's pretty much lake trout now and there for people like to fish. But anyhow, there's a lot of just great areas. There's Glacier Park, of course, which is people come from around the world to go see. That'd be in their backyard there. There's just a plethora of outdoor things to do. You don't have to go far to get away and get out of town.
The 60s, 70s, and 80s were a boom time for Celtic, Irish, and Scottish traditional music. Now, maybe this is just me being old and cranky, but it seems to me they just don't make them anymore, like some of the old bands like Moving Hearts, the Bothy Band, the Tannehill Weavers, Clannad, and Planxty. Now, this week, I'm going to be featuring the music of Planxty. It's music that I remember from my own time of exile in the islands, when all I had was a battery-powered radio with a cassette deck that I used to record some of these numbers off folk programs on RTE. Good days, musically speaking, anyway.
Many more are my foe, and betide me well or betide me ill, a hunting I will go. So Johnny has taken his good band bow, his arrows one by one, and he's away to Monimus for to bring the Dundeer down. Oh, Johnny shot and the Dundeer leapt, he's wounded her in the side, and between the waters and the woods the two dogs made her bride. And they ate so much of the medicine, they drank so much of the blood, that Johnny and his two grey dogs fell asleep as if they had been dead. And by there came a sly old man, a sly old man was he, and he's away to Esselmon for to tell on young Johnny. As I came in my body musk and down among yon scrubs, it was there I spied the bonniest youth lying sleeping between two dogs. And the bones that were on his coat were of a gold so good, and the two grey dogs that he lay between, their mouths they were dyed with blood. Then up and spoke the first forester, he was headsman over the mall. Can this be Johnny of Bradisby? Unto him we will crawl. His eye. Then the old Johnny fell out of his sleep, an angry man was he. He says the wildest wolf in all this wood would not have done so by me. And he's leaned his back against an oak, he's put against a stone, and he has fired on the seven foresters. He's killed them all but one, and he's broken seven of his man's ribs, his arm and his collarbone. And he has set him unto his horse to bring the tidings home. Johnny's good Ben Bow is broke, and his two grey dogs are slain, and his body lies in Monimusk, and his hunting days are done.
This is the last segment of the panel discussion we did with Charles Kraft and Andy and Don and myself on Saturday, March the 23rd.
I want to say something about what's happened to me, and I've been treated more fairly by the Jewish Daily Forward and the New York, what's that, New York Daily News,
yeah,
than I have by the Stranger in Seattle, the little paper that got this thing going.
Those well, guys- there's a reason for that. Any of you monitoring national news may hear the occasional reference to a federal settlement with the city of Seattle regarding bad behavior of police officers. And in reality, what's going on is a couple of them are using too much force, but a lot of it is related to ethnically biased policing. And what that means is the downtown Seattle Police Department likes to bust brownies who are breaking the law for some reason. You know, go figure. And what's gone on is we've recently had the revelation that there's a federal probe into the Seattle school district for biased discipline, where the stupid nigger kids that keep breaking rules, they have no other choice but to suspend them, mm-hmm. whereas you have one white kid that breaks a rule once, gets the point, doesn't do it again, and he doesn't end up suspended for some right, reason. Yeah. And so what's going on is that there's another federal probe into the Seattle area, and the feedback in the community has been that everybody's getting tired of this town bending over backwards, not to appear racist. And that really is that's the mentality, is that even if somebody is not necessarily a liberal lefty, they will bend over backwards not to be racist. And that's just Seattle's culture right now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Seattle has a reputation as being hippy-dippy central. But in point of fact, I found that it's just like everywhere else. The left-wing liberal elitists are actually a small minority of the population. Most people in Seattle, the white people, are normal working class people. They have decent values. They have families and jobs, and they probably vote Republican if they really thought about it. And a lot of them do every election. So we have liberal elitist establishments in Seattle and Portland, but they do not represent the majority of the people of the Northwest. And so what Charles has done is he's blasphemed against the Holocaust, but I'm sure the local lefty, hippy-dippy Seattle establishment is a lot more upset about it than, say, some Hebe sitting in New York, because you had basically a local reputation.
Yeah. The issue of the paper came out after the one I was in. They went after a homophobic florist.
Seems like a contradiction.
I know.
What so you, the sales paper.
What were you papers. Doing with your pansies?
I don't know. I thought you were putting this third.
I guess this idea of focusing the spotlight on some political correctness sells papers.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think like all power elites, the lefty libs in this country are getting nervous. You might think that having gotten Obama reelected that they would be confident, but I look at things like Huffington Post and SalonMagazine.com, and it's almost like they have gotten very shrill and hysterical, and they're just turning on any opposition.
Yeah.
Every day, Huffington Post and Salon rip into Rush Limbaugh like he's some kind of monster breathing fire or something. And I look at some of these hysterical attacks on him and Sean Hannity and anyone who dares to disagree with him in the media. I mean, these aren't racists or homophobes. They're just neocons, for God's sake. And I look at this and I think, my God, you guys won. Why the hysteria? Why so shrill? Why
fear.
The hatred?
I think that the elites and the power brokers, they're trying to generate fear and then can use fear to control people.
So yeah.
This idea that there's racist night riders out there just waiting to come in and lynch black people or to take Jews away and put them in gas chambers. I mean, this is ridiculous. They're generating they're making people just crazy with fear.
Well, as I mentioned, I mean, we've had incidents recently in the past few weeks where the FBI has been sleazing around the Northwest trying to find the NVA. And I just can't help but wonder, number one, are they really that damn stupid? Because the NVA is a fictional creation in my novels. But the second possibility, more sinister possibility, is they've decided that they're going to create an NVA.
Well, listen to this. That gal that wrote about me, she's written a second piece about me on her blog. It didn't make a hard copy.
Was it Jennifer Graves?
Her name is Jen Graves.
Jen Graves, yeah.
I started a fan club for a dead painter in Seattle named Morris Graves, and I made it kind of like a secret Masonic society. So it's called the Mystic Sons of Morris Graves. And Essentially, I like this guy's work, and I wanted to honor him. And so she got a hold of this thing about the Mystic Sons of Morris Graves that had been left at some site, right?
Yes.
And in it, the guy that wrote the story said that we don't allow women in the group. And so she's called me out as a chauvinist.
Misogynist, yeah.
Male chauvinist because women are not initiated into the Mystic Sons of Morris Graves, which doesn't exist. It's a complete hoax.
I noticed this about feminists. They really get upset if men have anything on their own where they're not admitted. It's almost like men are not trusted to get together or gather in groups of more than three because the femmes are afraid that they'll start talking about women behind their back or start plotting against women, whatever it is the hell we're supposed to do.
Well, it's just this idea of all-inclusiveness and equality. And let me just reiterate that the Mystic Sons of Morris Graves does not exist. And so I don't know how this gal can get on her soapbox and wag her finger at me for being...
Well, these people never let the facts get in the way of a good story.
I guess not.
I do have a question for you.
Yeah.
He asked about how did you get started on the Holocaust revision angle. How did you get started in white nationalism?
Let's see.
Or are you even?
Yeah, are you? Like
well, he's called himself a white nationalist, so...
Someone outed him as that. I mean...
Yeah, right.
White nationalism, I don't really remember how that happened, other than in the course of being able to express my views about my skepticism of the Holocaust story, I found forums at white nationalist sites where people were thinking like I was. So I guess it was sort of drifting over to the Vanguard News Network, where they have a forum, and then Carolyn Yeager started out as a revisionist. And she put up this site called The White Network. And then I met Greg Johnson of Countercurrents Publishing. He got in touch with me years ago because of my disaster wear, and he wanted to commission a plate of Savitri Devi. Do you know this?
Savitri Devi.
He had a job as an academic down south, and he was managing a Savitri Devi website, and he commissioned me to do a faience of her life with her picture on it. Mm-hmm. So Johnson sort of introduced me to the Council of Conservative Citizens, because he was working with them a little bit and publishing the Occidental Quarterly, which was one of their publications.
Which he was basically fired from for running an interview with me.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Yep. Uh-huh. Oh, well, listen, so I got introduced.
Well, there was other stuff going on there, but that was kind of like the icing on the cake.
This was an intellectual level of white nationalism that appealed to my intellectual curiosity, because Stormfront guys, I don't have much truck with that group because they don't seem to be doing much reading or thinking.
No, they don't. Stormfront is almost like Facebook or social media. I advise people, quite frankly, do not mess with either Stormfront or VNN because they are heavily monitored by the secret police. There have been cases on there, specifically in the case of the Bionic Backpack incident in Spokane, where the secret police have used people's VNN or Stormfront posts against them to try and track people down. And I personally...
You like Alex Linder? I think Alex Linder is funny. He makes me laugh out loud. Sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, he's like an H.L. Mencken.
He has a talent for his spin throws.
Yeah.
It's true. I agree.
Linder...
He doesn't participate much at the site he built.
Well, the thing is, I can't really make an objective judgment about Linder because he's banned me from VNN or any mention of the NF from VNN, and that kind of pisses me off. But a lot of people don't realize that this is why we get a lot of the so-called infighting in the movement. Linder has banned mention of the Northwest Migration and the Northwest Front or me from his forum because, frankly, we're the competition.
So it's about competing for listeners,
followers, as William L. Pierce said to me in the last civil letter he ever wrote to me, we're all chasing the same buck. And that's a lot of it. Basically, when somebody sends $10 to me to support my work, that's $10 they're not sending to Alex Linder or Don Black at Stormfront.
Right.
And it's unfortunate, but that's the way it is.
Well, that's to answer your question. My interest in revisionism led me to these websites where revisionist issues are being aired. And then as I looked deeper into what's going on in some of these places, I got more involved in racial awareness. And I came out in that article as a WASP, because that's what I was born as.
Was there a damn thing wrong with being of British descent?
Actually, I'm a German, so I mislabeled myself, but the family were WASPs. I mean, that's what they called us back in the 50s.
Yeah.
Episcopalian, white, Protestant, German, Norwegian, Seattleites.
I've actually started worked up my family tree recently on Ancestry.com, and I've got it back to 1822 so far. But I know a little bit more. I'm trying to find direct trace to a man named John Covington who emigrated in 1727, but from Coleraine in Northern Ireland. But all of my ancestors were either Scotch-Irish, so-called, which means Ulstermen, or Germans so far. And it's like you go out to the Custer battlefield. I don't know if you've ever been out there, but there's like a cenotaph on there that lists the names of all the 200 and some odd soldiers that died with Custer at the Battle of Little Bighorn. And other than the officers, you look at the rank and file, the sergeants and the privates and the troopers, every name is either German or Irish. You know, we were settled, and our early frontier history comes from certain very specific groups of people in Europe.
Well, we had waves of immigration mm-hmm. from different places, yeah. and the last wave was the Third World. Those doors were opened by Emanuel Sellers
right.
in about 1965.
Because of the, But, I mean, I'm not knocking, say, Italians. But the fact is, the Italians were about the last wave of white immigration that arrived in this country. And so they started coming in really seriously in big numbers about 1880s. So the simple fact is that most of them missed a large part of early American history. Now, this is just fact. There might have been Italian cowboys or Italian gunfighters, but they just weren't really part of that history. So the largest part of our history, we were an English-speaking nation, an English-speaking continent, if you want to include the colonial period, settled mostly by Protestants of British descent who spoke English as their primary language. And the result is we still have that in our culture today.
But, Wasn't there at one time a debate between what language was going to be American and it was settled? German
came close.
Yeah. Yes.
Now, there were areas of Germanic settlement, even in the early days, in Philadelphia, Delaware.
Now, just a moment. I grew up in a Zionist environment, and you hear in school with history teachers and everything, people will say, you ought to be glad we won World War II. We'd be speaking German today. You're telling me we might be speaking German anyway?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
They had to make a decision, I think, at the legislative level.
It was at the Continental Congress.
What did you say?
One vote is what I heard. Passed by one vote.
Oh, German lost by one vote?
Yeah, yeah.
Now they don't even teach it in the schools, you know. I mean, it's not language, it's excised.
In World War I, a lot of people, including my great-grandfather, changed their names because Germans were unpopular. But before World War I in this country, after English itself, German was the most common foreign language spoken in this country.
My dad spoke it.
Because there were so many immigrants from Germany.
Yeah.
So many ethnic Germans in the United States. In fact, it's hard to say at this point in time, but it used to be true when I was growing up that Germans were the largest ethnic group in the United States, and they may still be.
Hmm. I don't know about the numbers, but you would think that if they are the biggest, that they wouldn't stand for the kind of treatment they've been getting
they assimilated very easily because basically they were assimilating into what was essentially a Teutonic Anglo-Saxon culture, and so the two were very same, very, very similar, I should say. And so most people of Germanic descent nowadays just consider themselves to be American, and if you have a German-sounding name, they just don't think anything about it because the melting pot did melt up to a point when you started bringing in people of different races, and at that point they became unassimilable. But we have a definite American personality and character nowadays, and it's based on, if you want to call it diversity, but melding of the various white European nations. That can be done up to a point as long as the people involved are racially assimilable. But when you start bringing in different racial elements, no, the Jews, for example, never assimilated. Even they started coming in the 1870s. So
I thought they were here before.
There were some. First Jews arrived in this country in the mid-17th century, but we're talking about like one little synagogue in the middle of a whole white Anglo-Saxon Protestant
state.
I don't mind people making claims like that or talking if it's true. Let's see who's texting me. Okay, apropos of Charlie Kraft, I want to make a speculative comment or two here. Now, as many of you know, the Northwest Front is blacklisted from any establishment media publicity of any kind, at least in this country. The few times since the Front's foundation on the day following Black Tuesday of 2008 that I have been approached by news media for any purpose, it's been by foreign media in the UK and Canada, and even then under mostly unacceptable conditions. Now, I've only done two actual serious media interviews in the past 5 years, and I fended off a couple of BBC producers who wanted to send a camera crew out here all the way from London, and go into our members' homes and follow them around and record them like they were nature show hosts filming wildlife so they could slime white nationalism, and so I turned them down. There has been only one occasion when we got any publicity at all from the American media, and that came back in 2011 when the Bionic Backpack incident occurred in Spokane. In actual fact, the so-called bomb, which never went off, seems to have been an FBI hoax similar to the Edgar Steele case. In order to get funding and brownie points back at the J. Edgar building for the Spokane FBI office, they were able to coerce some poor slob into pleading guilty and getting 25 years for it, I think by threatening his ailing father. Now, interestingly, the Edgar Steele hoax was also put together by the Spokane FBI office. Their agents really, really don't want to get transferred to Los Angeles or Detroit or Brownsville, and I suppose I can't really blame them. I just wish they'd quit perjuring themselves on the witness stand and sending innocent old men to prison just so they can keep their split levels in the Spokane burbs. But getting back to the Bionic Backpack incident of 2011, cable TV dyke Rachel Maddow decided on no evidence whatsoever that we'd done it ourselves, and so she started screaming at the top of her lungs on her TV show that the wicked Northwest Front Nazis were being ignored by the FBI and the authorities in the Northwest. But by God, she wasn't going to ignore us. She was going to expose the Northwest Front, and she was going to be all over us like white on rice every day, so forth and so on, yada, 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 yada. She had a couple of blog posts to that effect on her website, which I and a number of others contributed to in the comments section. Then, after 2 days, all of the pro-NF comments, including mine, had been deleted from the blog posts and their accounts canceled. The posts themselves, the threads, were locked down, and the comment sections were closed. Now, obviously, somebody in authority in the liberal media establishment gave Miss Maddow a call and said, "Hey, Rach, we have to talk. We do not give this Covington person or his novels or the Northwest Imperative any publicity. None at all. Not ever." Anyway, you get the idea. We're blacklisted. Taboo from all establishment media publicity unless there's actual bloodshed like the murder of Jeff Hughes. Okay, now to drag myself back to the point regarding the recent sliming of Charles Kraft, I uploaded his interview with Radio Free Northwest to the website on the night of Sunday, March the 24th. And we started posting the link that night, and within 24 hours, we'd managed to sneak links to the interview into the comment sections of most of the Lefty Lib website articles that were smearing Charlie. And at that point, the hit pieces and the articles seemed to have come to a halt. Just poof, disappeared into a puff of smoke. I'm recording this on Tuesday, April the 2nd, and I've just concluded a massive Google search, and it would appear, from what I can find, that the flood of anti-Charles Kraft articles in the liberal media has suddenly slowed down to a mere trickle, and then it dried up completely. Okay, I did find one article published today, but that was just a reprint of the Seattle Times feature on an obscure arts website. The comments section on the second Stranger article was closed from the beginning, and the comments appear to have been closed on the original article that started all the hoopla 2 days after the Radio Free Northwest interview was aired, despite the fact that there were clearly a lot more people who wanted to comment. It just sort of cuts off right in mid-rant and rave, so to speak. No explanation. The last comment on there that I could find was March 28th. Okay, now, I may be wrong on this, and I may be exaggerating. I may be being narcissistic here. It could well be that the liberals just lost interest in Charlie and wandered off. Maybe. It's been known to happen, although most feeding frenzies I've been familiar with in the past lasted a lot longer than this, and usually they don't stop until they have done some kind of visible damage, something they can use as a trophy. They've gotten some white male arrested, so forth and so on. Now, maybe that's the reason for the sudden cessation of publicity. They just plain lost interest. Or it could be, just maybe, that the Northwest Front media blackout is much higher priority than destroying one single ceramic artist, and that the power of the Covington and NF blacklisting is sufficient actually to bring a media feeding frenzy to a halt, lest the frenzy directed at the target, in this case Charles Kraft, should generate some forbidden collateral publicity for the NF. If so, that's an impressive ability to have. Maybe I ought to start charging people who are being victimized, like Charles was being victimized by the media, for their Radio Free Northwest interviews. I wonder what Mel Gibson would pay to be interviewed on here. This is Planksty.
I had a first cousin called Arthur McBride. He and I took a stroll down by the seaside, a seeking good fortune and what might betide. 'Twas just as the day was a dawning, then after resting we both took a tramp. We met Sergeant Harper and Corporal Cramp, besides the wee drummer who beat up for camp with this rowdy dow dow in the morning. He says, my young fellows, if you will enlist, a guinea quickly shall have in your fist, besides a crown for to kick off of the dust, and drink the king's health in the morning. Had we been such fools as to take the advance, the wee bit of more and we had to run chance. For you think it no scruple to send us to France, where we would be killed in the morning. My young fellows, if I hear but one word, I instantly now will out with my sword, and into your bodies as strength will afford. So now, my gay devils, take warning. But Arthur and I, we took in the odds, we gave them no chance for to launch out their swords. Our whacking shillelaghs came over their heads and paid them right smart in the morning. For the wee drummer, we rifled his pouch, and we made a football of his rowdy dow dow, and into the ocean to rock and to roll, and batted a tedious returning. As for the old reindeer that hung by his side, we flung it as far as we could in the tide. To the devil I pitch you, says Arthur McBride, to temper your steel in the morning.
Okay, at this point in this week's podcast, I was going to offer you guys some lessons in the conspiratorial method, since one of our folks this weekend pointed out to me that most of you, being Americans of the 21st century, don't have a single clue as to what the hell I'm talking about when I say that, and you need me to hold your hand and walk you through it. Fine, I was going to do that, and then another topic came up. It's one of those that I touch on regularly, but which, in light of the current official hysteria down in Texas, maybe our comrades are right, and I better go over it once again. Now, things are heating up a little bit, and we may, I say may, be approaching a new phase in the ongoing disassembly of the old United States political and power structure. Now, in the last 2 months, a Colorado prison system commandant and two Texas prosecutors have bitten the dust. The official story is that this was done by wicked and evil white supremacists, of course. The steroid thugs shot down some white kid, a former convict, whom they say was a white supremacist, whatever the hell that is, and they claim that he killed the Colorado prison commandant, which he may or may not have done. Now, this one has already disappeared into this country's vast, we'll probably never know what really happened or why category. Anyway, it's now off the radar. Case closed, nothing to do with Mexican organized crime, nothing to do with corruption in the forced labor empire, move along, nothing to see here. But as of podcast date today, the authorities seem to be genuinely floundering as to who clipped the Texas prosecutors. And for the time being, at least, the power structure's credible monopoly of force is being successfully challenged to the point where one of the expensive suits down in Houston has already resigned from the Aryan Brotherhood legal case and fled in terror. That's a good thing in some respects, in that it demonstrates what I've always contended, that these people who rule us aren't the white people of Northern Ireland. They're just as much Americans as we are, with all our built-in weaknesses, and they can't take the heat if anyone should ever apply it. But on the other hand, it's not good, because whoever is doing this has made them afraid, and a frightened bully is a dangerous bully. Any wounded animal is always dangerous. Now, there's a good chance that the muscle men in the black body armor are going to start kicking in a lot of doors around the country again, just like they did in the Judge Lefkow case. Now, in that case, you'll recall, it turned out that neither Matt Hale nor any other so-called white supremacist had anything to do with it, but then truth or innocence no longer matters in Obama's America. Now, if nothing else, the droids now have an official case with a nice, shiny new case number, which they can use as an excuse to quote-unquote investigate leads, i.e. go tooling around the countryside in their silk suits and black SUVs, or late-model rental cars, burning all kinds of federal budget, knocking on doors with their just-a-few-questions shtick, so that they can try to develop informers. Now, they did this in the JT Reddy case last May, although that happened in Arizona and there never was any link to anyone in the Pacific Northwest. Now, they backed off after about a week when evidence emerged that Reddy was himself an FBI informant, and they decided that the less said about that one, the better. But that probably doesn't apply here. So, first off, as far as you guys are concerned, be advised and be ready. Make sure that you have nothing in your home or growing in your garden that shouldn't be there. Make sure your tail lights are all in working order and your license plate is up to date, and you wear your seat belts and drive nice and straight between the lines on the highway so that they have no excuse for a traffic stop. If and when you are approached, give them five words. I have nothing to say, and nothing more. That's for you guys. For me, the situation's a little more complex. Now, I know that some of you have questioned my recent internet chumminess with imprisoned dissident writer and historian Bill White. There are reasons for that, which I've explained elsewhere. What I may not have adequately explained is the legal relevance of his actual cases to what remains of freedom of speech in this country. Now, leaving aside the whole question of White's decision to show the world how clever and cute he was and publish ahead of time a magazine cover which clearly threatened the dictator, and that's what got him on the Democrats' shit list and caused his own destruction when a nigger in the 2008 Obama campaign saw the cover and screamed like a wounded gibbon over it. And leaving aside the torture, abuse, and non-consensual drugging inflicted on White in prison, which seems to have driven him a bit bonkers, we will look now at the legal aspects of White's ordeal. Now, these aspects are important because what the regime is doing here is establishing legal precedents which will eventually be used to imprison people based solely on internet speech through redefining the forensic definition of the terms threatening and credible threat. Now, this is an extremely complex web of horseshit, and I had to do some extensive research to refresh my memory. I'll try to boil it down as much as possible. I hope that one day Bill himself will sit down and write out the whole story for us all, but of course, from his viewpoint, the drama is still ongoing, and when you start writing a story, it's always good to know how it's going to end. Now, White was originally arrested, if memory serves, on 8 charges. 4 were dropped before trial because they were so bizarre and blatantly bogus that even a federal judge couldn't swallow them. Now, that's bogus, let me tell you. White was convicted on 4 charges, 3 of which were eventually dismissed on First Amendment grounds, although not before White spent 2.5 years in prison and had lost everything he had, including his wife and daughter. All these convictions were based on communications and postings to the internet, wherein even the prosecutors have admitted in court documents that there was no threat of violence or incitement to commit any criminal act of any kind. Bill White is in prison now for speech only. Speech which 2 federal appeals courts have already ruled to be constitutionally protected, and for which he actually was released for a period of about 14 months. I'm really tempted to get into the story of his subsequent rearrest after the government appealed the acquittals, which I always thought wasn't supposed to happen in this country, but then a lot of things are happening today that shouldn't be happening. I put it this way, the regime claimed that White's original sentencing was too lenient, and so they dragged him back into court and got a Jewish judge to re-sentence him with a so-called enhanced sentence on a charge for which he has already been acquitted and ordered released by a federal appeals court. In other words, Bill White is currently in prison for a crime for which he has been officially exonerated. Oh, it gets better. But I don't have the time to go into all this now. A full accounting of this would keep us here until midnight. But what we need to look at here are the precedents established by the original convictions, because those are what's going to be used against future white dissidents in order to imprison us for speech only, while maintaining the thinnest of tissue-thin pretexts that that's not what we're being locked up for at all, and we've committed some kind of crime, i.e. that we are quote-unquote threatening somebody. Now, what they did in the Bill White case, and in the Brewington case, and probably some others I'm not yet aware of, is they have reshaped and redefined the legal conception of what constitutes a threat. It used to be that was pretty clear. If you point a gun or wave a knife at somebody and say, "I'm gonna kill you, you son of a bitch," that's a threat. Most states used to use that famous legal construction, the reasonable man, or reasonable person it would be these days. If a reasonable person would consider a threat credible due to such circumstances as, say, the presence of a weapon in the hand, obvious motive or intent, or a subsequent actual assault, then yes, it was a threat. Now, what's been done in White's case, and in several others, such as that really hideous Daniel Brewington case in Indiana, is to allow the alleged victim alone to define what constitutes a threat. And by the way, a threat doesn't need to be actually carried out. All it needs to do is cause the victim to feel apprehensive. Now, needless to say, the alleged victim of this apprehension is always a member of a politically protected class or privileged minority, while the alleged threatener always just happens to be a white male holding views to the right of center and who is speaking about those views in public, usually on the internet. Now, in White's case, one of the charges against him was that he allegedly threatened a Virginia bank employee in an irate email he sent regarding some problem with a mortgage he had on one of his rental houses he owned at the time, so this wasn't in a racial or political context. He didn't send this email to any one particular employee or person at the bank, but the witness against him on the stand was some young black female clerk or secretary who allegedly opened the email and felt threatened by it. Now, I've talked to people who followed these trials a lot closer than I was able to do at the time, and apparently the prosecution really put on the dog with this one, or put on the monkoid, I should say. This critter rocked up on the witness stand, dolled up to the nines, and from the descriptions I've heard, she probably had cute little pigtails with ribbons and bows in her hair. And she said, "You see, Your Honor, when I read that horrible email, and I know that come from that awful, evil man, Bill White, and I done seen on TV how Bill White am a neo-Nazi, and I just felt so apprehensive. I knowed he a white supremacist, and I was just so in fear of my life, motherfucker." Okay, you get the idea. Add to that a jury half full of niggers and whites who would never dare to brave the negroid wrath in the jury room for fear of being called racist themselves, and you can guess the result. The legal precedent has now been set. Bill White was convicted not because of anything he actually did, and not because his words contained anything that anybody within reasonable shouting distance of rationality might consider to be a threat. Bill White was convicted because of who and what he was, and because of who or what his alleged victim was, i.e. the color of both of their skins. From now on, any of us may be sent to prison, not for what we do or even for what we say, but for who we are. All that's necessary for them to get me or you or anybody is for some nigger or Jew to get up on a witness stand and testify that our public commentary on any subject whatsoever makes them feel apprehensive and in fear of their life. Now, you don't think that can happen? That is precisely what has already happened in the Daniel Brewington case. And there, both Brewington and the judge are white, so you don't even have the racial element. All you've got is a judge that doesn't want to be criticized for the decisions he throws down from the bench. This magistrate claims that Brewington's refusal to shut up on the internet about the destruction of his family, even though the prosecution itself admits that there was no threat or incitement to violence, made him feel apprehensive. And so Brewington is now doing 2 years while the case oozes its constipated way through the courts. The law in this country has now reverted to the Middle Ages, when heretics were burned at the stake. Now, in the second Bill White case of major importance, the alleged threatening of a juror in a federal trial 5 years before, the Jewish judge decided that a so-called credible threat existed because, pay attention to this now, guys, this is important. A threat existed because White was allegedly posting for the benefit of, and I quote, an inherently potentially violent audience, specifically white supremacists. That, by the way, is racial profiling, which is also supposed to be illegal, but we all know that these laws don't apply to white people. Remember, in this society, the media writes our narrative and we are not allowed to dissent. We are not who we say we are. We are who the media says we are. If you don't believe that, ask Charles Kraft. Or look at my Wikipedia entry, which I've been trying to get corrected for 7 years now and been ignored and banned for my trouble. We are going to be judged not for our deeds, but for our media narrative. We are going to be judged because of what others say about us, not for what we say or do. In other words, Bill White published information which was on the public record that could have been found by anyone on Google in about 3 minutes, which I think, in fact, is where he did get it. But because he was a media creation called Bill White, a so-called white supremacist and neo-Nazi, and again, I'm not really sure just what the hell the dictator's servants mean by those terms, and because he was allegedly posting this information for an unknown, unnamed audience of other so-called white supremacists who are, quote-unquote, inherently potentially violent, this is a whole bunch of people who may or may not even exist, then the real Bill White, not the liberal media narrative, has to go to prison with an enhanced sentence for a crime for which he has already been legally acquitted and exonerated by an appeals court. If, say, Chris Matthews of MSNBC or Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Had published this individual's name on their websites, I'm sure they would have been in no danger of arrest because they're left-wing extremists and part of Team Obama. They have freedom of speech. They've earned it through subservience to an uncouth third-world despot. We don't have it. Okay, I can tell I'm running long again. This will be the last music break from Planxty.
Oh, Napoleon Bonaparte, you're the cause of my woe. Since my bonny light horseman to the wars he did go, broken-hearted I'll wander, broken-hearted I'll remain. Since my bonny light horseman in the wars he was slain.
Boney commanded his armies to stand, and proud waved his banners, all gaily and grand. He leveled his cannons right over the plain, and my bonny light horseman in the wars he was slain.
Oh, Napoleon Bonaparte, you're the cause of my woe. Since my bonny light horseman to the wars he did go, broken-hearted I'll wander, broken-hearted I'll remain. Since my bonny light horseman in the wars he was slain.
And if I was some small bird and had wings and could fly, I would fly o'er the salt sea where my true love does lie. 3 years and 6 months now since he left this bright shore. Oh, my bonny light horseman, will I ne'er see you more?
Oh, Napoleon Bonaparte, the cause of my woe. Since my bonny light horseman to the wars he did go, broken-hearted I'll wander, broken-hearted I'll remain. Since my bonny light horseman in the wars he was slain.
And policeman who was killed in the war.
Okay, tell you what, I know the music this week was a little esoteric for most of you, and I'm sure there's some grumbles out there about all the Irish stuff that hurts your American ears and confuses your brain and makes you listen to words and think about them, so I promise you, next week it will be all skinhead rock, okay? All clanging electric guitars and screamed lyrics you can just barely understand because of the lousy mixing done on somebody's home computer in a basement, okay? Well, I'm running way long here. And I don't really have time to get any further into this topic, as fascinating and necessary as it is, at least not in this podcast. So let me sum up all this for the umpteenth time. I am not threatening anybody on this podcast or in anything I ever say or write. I am threatening everybody. That is to say, I am quite deliberately threatening the entire order of society, which has turned our lives in this land into a weird kind of hell, which is one part lunatic asylum, one part Groundhog Day, one part 1984, one part Monty Python movie, and all of the above lived in an endless overflowing toilet. We are not going to be saved by acts of individual violence carried out either by people who are so desperate for some kind of vindication and personal vengeance that they no longer care whether they live or die, or else by people who have cracked up and are hearing voices in their heads. If any of you are toying with the idea of doing anything of the kind, don't. We have to win the game, not kick over the table. Now, if there's any doubt at all as to my personal attitude towards individual acts of symbolic resistance, what the left calls propaganda of the deed, then the following clip from 2010 will explain my views on that point very clearly. I try to replay this once a year or so. It may do some good, it may not. Now, for those of you who have already heard this several times, I apologize for the repetition. For those who haven't, listen and do as I say. This is Harold Covington speaking, and the date is February the 18th, 2010. This morning, at around 10 o'clock Central Standard Time, a man named Joseph Stack crashed a light aircraft into the Internal Revenue Service offices in the Federal Building in Austin, Texas. He left behind a long online manifesto, or final communication, in which he described, with great passion and somewhat less coherence, the shafting that, like so many white men of his generation, he received at the hands of the America he was raised to believe in. At the present time, the authorities are only admitting to Stack himself being dead. Looks like the poor bastard didn't even manage to take a single bureaucrat in a suit with him. It's not clear at this point whether Stack had any white racial leanings or not, but his is a condition of mind and soul we can all sympathize with. To quote his own farewell address to the world, he said, "I have just had enough. In this, he speaks for all white Americans, and his willingness to make his point by giving up his own life tells us that, at least, he meant what he said. I've spoken before in my writings of what the radicals of the 19th century referred to as the propaganda of the deed. Well, this was it. Was his act a complete waste? I hope not, but I'm not sanguine about his chances of accomplishing anything. Americans mostly exist on a Beavis and Butthead level. Symbolic gestures like stacks go right over their heads. But I want to take this opportunity to speak to all of you out there, both men of Stack's generation and mine, and also to young white kids who have been raised under political correctness and who understand that America no longer holds out any hope or any future for them. Time and again, over the past 40 years, I've seen white men snap like this. They go to a shopping mall or a former workplace armed with a couple of semi-autos, and they come in the door smoking, or else just go off on a pointless spree, blasting anything black or brown that moves until the cops catch up with him, and either the guy gets shot by the police, or else he sticks the muzzle in his own mouth and he blows himself away. I know that right now there are untold numbers of angry white males out there who have been driven to the point of homicidal rage by the terrible injustice, the unfairness, and the tyranny of mind, body, and spirit, which is Obama's America in 2010. I know some of you in the back of your minds are contemplating doing something of this nature. You wouldn't be human if you weren't. I know some of you listening to my voice right now are thinking in your desperation and your righteous rage at the wrongs that America has done to you that going out in a blaze of glory might just be worth it. I'm telling you now, no, it isn't. There are practical reasons why it isn't worth it. Not the least being that there's no way you could possibly inflict enough damage on the enemy to justify the sacrifice of a single racially aware white life. There are so few, so terribly few of us, and every one of you is precious to me and to our racial future. If you were able to kill 100 or 1,000 street niggers or Mexicans or federal bureaucrats, the scales still wouldn't balance in our favor. I'm reminded of the words of General George Patton, who said, "Nobody ever won a war by dying for his country. You win by making the other poor dumb bastard die for his country." You may reply, "It's my life and I can give it up when and how I want." No, it isn't. Your life belongs to your people and to the moment of history into which you have been born. It is not yours to throw away. The late Pastor Robert Miles once said, "A racist is someone who knows who he is." If you have attained the precious gift of racial consciousness, of knowing who you are, then it is your inescapable duty to use that consciousness to secure the existence of our people and the future for white children. You are not in this for yourself, for your own benefit or your own private vengeance. Now, there have been ages in the past wherein white men were free to live for themselves and their own desires. This time and place we live in is not one of them. Many of you will have read my Northwest Independence novels, and I want to remind you of what I had a number of my characters say in all four of those books in one form or another. The duty of a revolutionary is not to kill people, but to free people. Our goal is to change the world, and all of our personal lives, actions, and decisions must be subordinated to that objective. Any damn fool can die for his country and his cause. Only a true patriot and a man of honor and integrity can find within himself the strength of character, the self-discipline, and the iron will to live for it. That kind of moral strength and character is what I demand of everyone associated with the Northwest Front, and it is what all of you should demand of yourselves. Our time is up now, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sacha Andaban. Freedom. For poor old Ireland, Uncle Bitter was their